If those of you who, for example, may have not sat in on one of the courses of the World of Chemistry, this is an endorsement. They offer it during the daytime, they offer it at night. It's a wonderful course for one to go ahead and participate. But David is quite familiar with this room. He usually sits just about over there because he's been a longtime member of Senate. And the only time he comes up here is to really go ahead and report on the honorary doctorates that are being presented to Senate for approval. He's also the university marshal as well. He has other things, for example, that he's achieved. He led the initiative to go ahead and establish what is called the COOL system, whereby lectures are recorded, and that's about 10 or 12 years ago that he started this, and now students who miss lectures, where the COOL system is in effect, can actually view the lectures at a later stage, and they are accessible through my courses. He also had another involvement, and this has actually led to some of the new policies that we have with respect to multiple choice exams. So that was a long time in his life whereby David actually developed a program whereby students writing multiple exams based on their seating patterns, one could try to go ahead and see if there were similarities with respect to their exam. In other words, not on getting the right answers. We expect good students to get the right answers, but do they get the same wrong answers? And that was quite interesting, and that's a system that's being used at McGill as well as at other schools. But you'd rather hear David talk about symmetry, but I felt that you had to know some of the great achievements he's had at this university. David.
Thank you, Morty, very much, and thank the committee for the opportunity to talk to you today. This looks like Senate, I guess. Maybe we should pass a budget. How would that do? I want to talk today about a topic that is pervasive in the world, really. It's one that chemistry uses, physics uses. In fact, our new principal used it in X-ray crystallography when she got her PhD here at McGill. Some years ago, architecture, urban planning all use this concept, but I think there's no single course where symmetry is taught as such. We think about symmetrical objects, for instance, squares, very simple, or if I can maneuver it appropriately. Triangles. Three-sided figures. The question could then be, and I think architects are amongst the best in trying to find ways to think outside the box, but how could we convert this object into a circle, one of the great objects of all of our time? And the answer is not so difficult. It's more of a trick, I think, than it is symmetry, but it does illustrate, I think, what symmetry is about. And when you look at a picture like this, what we see is four dimensions, really. We're seeing width, length, elevation, and time, because this was when McGill had the elm trees, and they're no longer here. And if we take a quick peek at what happens over time, we go to another month where we have a little snow, and we go to the modern time, and it's not even up to date yet, for the simple reason that, of course, the arts building isn't clean like it is right now. It's been cleaned and looks really sensational. The other part, well, this is just to illustrate the title. It's too bad that the word symmetry wasn't symmetrical, and I'm going to look at that idea as we go through. But you look at the university from another perspective, and it's extremely asymmetric. It doesn't look like anything symmetric in it, in the buildings. But there are, of course, features. And what I want to do today is to talk about the visual aspects. We're just going to look at stuff. It's not going to be very complicated because I don't think I could achieve that. The idea of the Nobel Prize in Physics being involved with broken symmetry, particles, and the like, I'm not going to talk about. So if you came for that, you can be excused immediately. I don't know about that. I'm going to talk about much more fundamental, simple things, choices that sometimes half the population sometimes has to make a judgment about, and it's illustrated right here. Which one to choose? Now, that may seem a triviality, but it actually isn't. It turns out that the two stripe directions are really from two different parts of the world. This is one of them. This is the other one. And one of them is from the UK, one of them is from North America. And the question is, which one is which? If you're very observant, you might make a guess. So the idea would be, this is upper left from the viewer to the lower right, upper left to the lower right. You might think that we have the one on the right would be North America. Turns out that's the one from the UK. And the reason is that while it was bought in Burlington, Vermont, it's actually made in England. It was just one of those things. But that's the way those are. That's really not terribly important, but it does illustrate how the different countries have put their stripes in their ties. I'm just going to go through a couple of quick examples of patterns like that that come into play. And in this case, obviously, we got a problem right down here. They weren't thinking completely clearly, so if they reverse all the tiles trying to think that maybe this is the way to go, that's not going to solve it either. It's the same problem, and we're back to the same problem. So there are interesting things like this. This kind of a pattern, very symmetric, and I hope that it's showing you black and white dots. That's just a kind of an optical illusion. They're all white dots, but you're seeing them as black? Yeah, this is an oddity, I think. And another oddity about symmetry, we would know that this is not oriented spatially vertically because it's the Leaning Tower. And here's another picture of the Leaning Tower. Actually, is it the same or is it different? And it certainly looks to be far to the right, on the right, but if we just move it over, it's absolutely the same. And what this was, I thought, interesting, McGill Vision Research Unit in the RVH won a prize a few years ago for the best illusion. Just an interesting McGill connection I thought might be kind of fun to show. Well, if we look at symmetry elements, that is the very simplest aspect of this. This is a symmetrical object, obviously. We all know this. Left and right-handers use this with equal ease, whereas this one is going to be used by a right-hander with some success, but not by a left-hander. It'd be poured on the toes. I don't know what would happen to it. And there are no symmetry elements to this. It's an asymmetric object. And this has relevance in chemistry. It has relevance in many, many institutions and situations. I want to go over a few of these that are kind of fun. If we look at the world around us, one of the kind of situations that we take a look at are people. I couldn't resist this picture. I have no idea if it's a fake. It's not photoshopped, but this is the one that I wanted to illustrate within this. You take the letters, teach, and you reflect across them, and you get learn. Now, that's just clever use of letters, and we hope that actually works, and that's what I hope will work today. This was the picture I was thinking about. I have no idea. It's a very asymmetric situation, and maybe it's a fake, but it's taken a long time ago, so I kind of doubt that it's photoshopped or anything like it. But one of the areas of great interest, I think, to everybody is the notion of facial symmetry. And if you take somebody like Edgar Allan Poe and take the notion that was quite widely espoused a few years ago, maybe 15 years ago or so, and that is that the left side of the brain and the right side of the brain subtly affect the opposite sides of the face. Therefore, you had a kind of a mirror into the personality of the individual. Supposedly, this would be true. That is, whether the emotional side or the rational side. Well, here's E.A. Poe, and that's the normal picture of Poe. But if we take, for instance, this side of his head, the right side of the head, which is governed supposedly by the left side of his brain, and that is the idea, that's going to be the rational side of Poe. And we piece it over here and blend it together, we have a sort of a reasonable looking picture. But the opposite one, where the left, where the right sides of the face are reflecting the left brain idea, namely the emotional side, we get this as Poe, which is a little more dramatically disagreeable, I think. And of course, he wrote a lot of unusual books. Well, the next step, of course, is to do this with a face that I see more than most any other, and that's my own. So I thought, let's do this. So the middle picture should reflect the rational side and it's a reasonable looking, a little dopey looking maybe, but a reasonable looking individual. But the, I won't say irrational side, but the emotional side is this. And it should be somewhere in a post office. And if you make it in color, it doesn't really change anything. So I thought, well, I got to give it another go. Take a look at it again. And so, reasonable picture, I thought, not so unreasonable. And here's the rational two sides. Very reasonable, bland-looking, but reasonable person. And I'm going to have to now go backwards to the rest of the talk and end the talk, but I will show you this horrific picture. And so I tried yet again. But this, I think, shows, and this has been discounted completely, and I hope that you will remember that it has been discounted completely. Here's the outward side, as it were, and here's the inward, and they're all bad, as it were. You can have a lot of fun with this. In fact, I'll show you one last one that's very interesting, and that's these two. But it's a very easy trick to pull off. All you need to do is give one of your small cameras, just go like this, click, bring it into Photoshop or even PowerPoint, split the picture in half, flip the picture, guide it over to the other side, blend the two together, and you can amuse and entertain your friends around the world and send them the latest picture of yourself, but give them one of the other two pieces, not the normal one, and they'll just say, there's something wrong with this picture. They'll surely say that, I feel. Well, in this image, it's not possible to tell where it was taken because we have no reference point. One is real, one is simply the mirror form of that. This one, we know immediately what's what because letters, many letters, of course, are asymmetric and have like the letter L and N, as opposed to the letters O and I, obviously. Nature provides some seemingly highly symmetric objects, but if you look in detail at any one of these clovers, or any one of these lily pads, rather, you will note that there's small differences in all of them, yet there are all fourfold axes of symmetry. You can see that just rotate at 90 degrees, you more or less retain the original. But they're not exactly identical. And it is said that there is no identical leaves, grasses, or anything else in nature. It always builds some asymmetry into it. This was one, my wife is very adept at finding four-leaf clovers. I have never found a four-leaf clover. She'll say, let's go walking and look for clovers. And I'll say, why? I can't ever find any. And she'll be walking along and all of a sudden stop and there's a four-leaf clover. It's supposed to be lucky. I've never been lucky. That's a five-leaf clover that she found. It would have been completely missed by me, that's for certain. But the five-fold axis, the six-fold axis are present in many different plants, and they're just, I think, to look at them and think about how nature puts all of these together. This is a morning glory shoot with a right-handed helix. And one wonders, this is a North American one, whether in Australia it goes the other way. I don't know, like the northern and southern hemispheres and how the water goes down in the toilet counter and regularly clockwise. Trees, if they grow very, very slowly, will sometimes have this kind of a twist to them. And I think that's probably more a function of wind, but I'm not really sure. Animals generally are bilaterally symmetric, like this goat, but you see that their mirrors, the mirror form of the horns, is almost in perfect synchrony with the animal. But there's one animal that doesn't have two horns, it has essentially one vestigular tooth, and that's the very interesting narwhal. And if you look carefully at the tooth that extends, it has a chirality to it or a handedness to it. And this, I think, is a very unusual situation. And the animals don't seem to duel with these. It's just somehow a tooth that grows very, very long in the animal. And I noticed once in the airport in Vancouver, there was this carving. And I looked very carefully at the tusk, as it might be called. And they didn't go to the trouble to make it twisted, which I thought was an interesting omission, although it was a beautiful piece. Well, it turns out that they're born this way and they're twisted from birth. This is a baby narwhal tooth that a colleague of mine had, and you can see the left-handed twist to this. And they just grow longer and larger, like with teeth. But the next picture is a little disturbing, but it was a most unusual picture, because if you think about it, what would be the final answer to a double-tusked narwhal that might exist? Would the tusks reflect each other like they do in the goats and other animals with horns? Or would they be both right-handed, or would they be both left-handed? And so this gets into another deep debate, I guess. And so in the Narwhal News, it turned out, if there is such a paper, that this is the head of a gigantic narwhal that was double-tusked, and it showed up, instead of double-left, which all of the single-tusked narwhals were to that point, it showed up as double-right, until they discovered that they'd printed the picture upside down. And so you can take a small piece of trivia away today that you will never use again anywhere, I think, is that all narwhals have double tusks. All narwhals have left-handed tusks, whether they're double narwhaled, tusked, or single. This animal is called a crossbill. And if you think about what the bills of birds really look like, of course, the reality is that they come down even. And almost every single bird, except this one, where the bill is crossed. And they have been observed to pick up seeds on the ground in a particular fashion, either clockwise or counterclockwise, depending on how that works for the lower part of their bill. And I don't know that there's any difference, North America or Australia, to this, but it's an unusual asymmetry to the animal. It's not bilaterally symmetric whatsoever at that point in the animal. These are two of the world's ugliest but most delicious fishes, I would say. The flounder, which has initially, when they are born, the eyes on either side of the head, as you would expect most fish to have, but they are bottom livers. They live on the bottom of the water in which they're in. And somehow, and I can't explain it, but one eye wanders in the tissue to the other side. And that's why you see the flounder with both eyes on the right side, and the turbot with both eyes on the left side. They're closely related, but they're mirrored to one another. So I think this is why when you buy these fish, they're all cleaned, all dressed. You never see the heads. I don't think you'd even buy them if you saw the heads. At least I wouldn't want to myself. And I took this on the surface of a car one day in the summertime. Beautifully bilaterally symmetric, but not perfect. If you go to the right side and look for the specks, and the dots and the colors, they're a little bit different, but they're certainly attempting to be bilaterally symmetric overall. And another area of symmetry is that you all know about are snowflakes. They're all six-sided. I don't think there's ever been a five-sided or a four-sided snowflake. And even the larger crystal forms are hexagonal, as you can see in the left-hand or in the right side of that picture. So here's an example of one, and you've seen many kinds of pictures of these, and there's others, and they all look a little different, but if you look at them in detail, real detail, you see that there are small nuances to the crystal itself, even though globally and generally they are hexagonal. This picture showed up a while later than the ones that I saw just showed you, and you could think about how that might actually have taken place. It's a 12-sided snowflake. Or is it? Anybody want to make a stab? Two snowflakes sitting on top of each other, which is what they eventually said. Yes, we didn't really discover a 12-sided snowflake. It's two sixes that happen to coalesce in that fashion that looks like a clock all the way around, but rather beautiful. And it also turns out that people, I find this unusual form of study, but they have worked out the temperature on the horizontal axis and the saturation of the air as to what kind of snowflakes are going to be precipitated, whether they are hollow columns, solid prisms, plates, sectored plates, dendrites, thin plates. I mean, somebody did all this work. And they published it, and I give them credit for it. It's an enormous amount of detail. So people worry about unusual things. People also look at symbols, and I want to get into this a little bit. This is taken at the American University of Sharjah in the Middle East, in the Emirate States. And if you look at this carefully, of course, it splits down the middle, the left and right sides perfectly reflect each other, except the language on top, Sharjah, and then in Arabic on the right-hand side. But a really beautiful example, and you see this very often, of course, in buildings. Symbols become important and how people look at them. And I thought I would show you this one that you may not have seen. You see the two black kings. They're facing each other. Interesting feature is that if you rotate these a little bit around, not moving them off the plane of the paper, now they have emerged to where they're looking away from each other. Kind of a curiosity. You can amaze and astound your friends with the next time you play cards. And symmetry plays a role in a new deck of cards, if you've ever noticed this. They don't go ace to king, ace to king, ace to king, ace to king like you'd think they would. They go this way. Ace to king and then king back down to ace. I don't know why, but it has permitted an interesting little name. Some of you may know this. Question is, what is the name of those two kings where it splits in the middle and goes off to the right-hand side? Anybody know? Well, you can look it up. It's true. They're called the kissing kings. I don't get it, but that's what they are called. And there's another little feature that I've found interesting about playing cards, which of course have their own internal symmetry, 13 cards, in the deck for four different suits. But if you spread them out like so, they're all over the place. They're in any kind of order. One might wonder how many possible orders are there when you're starting to get into numbers in the symmetry situation. It turns out you can calculate this on Google. You can do a lot of interesting things on Google, as you know. How many total arrangements are there possibly to have? And the answer is 52 factorial. 52 with an exclamation point. You put that into Google, it gives you the number. And the number is 8 times 10 to the 67th, which is a number of more particles than there are in the universe, which means that I think every time you shuffle the cards, you're getting a completely unique arrangement from now forever. If you calculated that there's been, let's say, 12 billion people who've lived on the planet, and all they did for all of those 12 billion years was shuffle cards 20 hours a day at the rate of 5 per minute or something like that, you aren't even close to this number. And if you look at the whole number, it's down here. So there's a lot of complexity in numbers, a lot of interesting things that you can do. And the symbols that we use, such as factorial, a nice symmetric symbol, is a way to calculate this. But here's a symbol that I think you all know, the yin and yang symbol, the notion of a little bad in every good person, a little good in every bad person. And if you see, we have the dark part on the left-hand side, and we can rotate that 180 degrees just by inverting the white and the black, which we'll see to be done over a few seconds right here. And we've got another yin-yang symbol, but a different one than the other. And I don't know which is the official one, to be honest with you. And here's yet another way just to reverse back to where we were before. So symmetry shows up all over the place, is what I would like to think. And another symbol that's quite well known, called the golden rectangle, or phi. It's a proportional way of looking at life and at what's in life. You start with a square. There's other ways to do this, but one of the ways, you start with a square, you split it down the middle, and then you extend that to the side and extend it all the way down to the bottom, and then fill in the difference. That particular shape has grown to be very popular over centuries, because people will try to do is to make picture frames in this shape. It's generally pleasing to the eye. Buildings to be constructed in this particular shape and form. And it's, if you look at the visual part of the single lens reflex camera, it's a 3x2, or roughly 3x2 arrangement overall. The actual, and so here's the Parthenon fitting into that kind of shape frame. And the actual numbers are 1.62 to 1. Now that is shown in paintings, and artists use this relationship many times. Of course, obviously not all the time. Bathers by Seurat. You can divide this in this kind of framework, and you have 3x2 arrangements throughout the painting, including the one right here of the center of interest of the boy. That's a 3x2 setup or relationship. And that number of 1.6 2 to 1 was created really by a mathematician in Italy almost a thousand years ago, Fibonacci. Some people will know a Fibonacci series of numbers, and I've been amused a couple times to give a lecture like this to a chemistry group, and they don't seem to know the Fibonacci series very well, but I gave it to some physicists once, and they all started to laugh when I showed this cartoon. This must be Fibonacci's. 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8. And the reason is that this is a curious set of numbers that you can relate to by taking 0 and 1, adding them together to get 1, adding 1 and 2 to get 3. It's the previous 2 to add, and many of you may know this one. 5 and 8 are 13, and 13 and 21 are 34, and then you go up to, and when you get to about that number, 144, if you take the ratio of that number to the previous number, and if you go further, you get the same ratio. It distills down to exactly the same ratio of 1.62 to 1, and that's what you see here on the right-hand side, 1.62. And that particular shape is exactly what we have looked at with respect to, say, the Parthenon, as it fits directly into that framework. So numbers are, I think, very interesting. We'll get back to numbers in a minute, but I wanted to do a small piece on music and art, but the art will be focused specifically on the art of Escher, as some of you may know. And I was thinking, as I was talking to the evening manager at the faculty club, Mr. Gruev, and he said, you know, I'm hoping I can come to your talk today because I was thinking about this topic, and then I got to thinking about what others might think, and I suspect most of you are wondering, where is this symmetry thing that I have in my head going to show up? And it probably won't, because it's so many that are available to be looked at, thought about. Why not look at this area, that area? And so in music, I'm just going to do a couple of ideas. And I'm going to do one that J.S. Bach, which I think is an interesting one. And I think many of these brilliant composers would indulge themselves by writing pieces of music that had symmetry associated with them. And if you look at a little harder to see in the dark, but the top stanza is the same forwards as the bottom stanza is backwards. And the second stanza is the same forward as the top stanza on the bottom is backwards. Now, one would think this might show up in a symmetric sounding piece. It doesn't, but it's called a canon. And it shows up in an interesting way, and you can hear this played. I hope it will work. That's forwards. And there they are together. And I was given the opportunity to try this one out, which is Fred Casper's Palindrome Canons by, are you in the room? Gentlemen, thank you. Who gave me this tip on this particular formation of this canon. And what you'll see on the bottom is a rendition of the music on the lower right. And it's mirrored as you go up to this position. You see the two going backwards, going forwards. And it has not a really very symmetric sound, but it's a very interesting one. And I have to go to the internet for this, and let's see if I can make it actually happen. Yeah. And you'll see the music. Victor Chisholm for that. I really appreciate it. It doesn't have a flowing symmetric look or sound, but it is so intricately put together that it actually sounds in an interesting way, but it's one way and one the other, and they're identical to one another. So pretty unusual. Now, let me navigate out of here. Art often, of course, has symmetry associated with it, but no one, I think, ever has put together images like Maurits Escher, the Dutch graphic artist. He had a mental capacity, a capacity to view things in really unusual ways. I have no idea what this is supposed to mean. I think our new principal would have a good view on this, because crystal molecules crystallize in very specific forms, such as these fish are being relegated to very specific places in this, with eyes. I mean, it's very odd. I don't think there's any question. This one, I think, is even more interesting. It's devils and angels, and it's easy to see where the devils are and the angels, but it's also, Escher was capable of filling the entire canvas with that same kind of image as it just went to the edges. It's called tessellation. It's a mathematical capacity, a mathematical opportunity to do this. And the center part, of course, is a threefold axis of symmetry. So it'd be kind of fun to invert the black and the white with the devils and the angels and make it look a little different as it goes through this transformation. And now the prominent one is the devil. And then we can get it back to normal as to what he actually drew, which is this one. He also did things that are terribly asymmetric. I mean, they're disturbingly asymmetric. I wish I had this piece, because it's probably worth $1 million or more. Every single object in it, which fills the entire canvas, is asymmetric, right down to, where is it here? There's a guitar that has a bent, yeah, over here on this side, just to make it asymmetric. And then you have the flatfish, and you have strange animals that have no reality in any place. A small elephant with the trunk curled underneath the camel. But I think his most wonderful piece that you may have seen on sweatshirts or t-shirts or even on writing paper is called Day and Night. And I think this is one of the best examples of four dimensions, length, width, elevation, and time, that there really has ever been done. And he has these birds tessellating across the top, black turning into white. He has the right side, which of course is nighttime, the left side is daytime, and the boat's going in opposite modes, as you can see. Just a really brilliant piece to think it up and put it together, but I thought it might be fun to invert this for about 12 seconds to simulate 12 hours as we go from daytime on the left and nighttime on the right to the inverse of that. So that's 12 hours for 12 seconds. Imagine if we did it for 12 hours. And then back again. So when you see that, as you probably will in stores, you can think about how this job was done and how he portrayed it. He had very interesting thoughts, I think. Chicken and egg, right hand, left hand. What on earth is going on? How did this happen? I thought it was just a brilliant piece. The hands are just so perfectly put together. So Escher's work has many different schemata in them, including ones you may have seen where you are walking up some steps and all of a sudden you're below where you started, a really curious way of showing things. And probably one of the more, I think, kind of fun arenas is to look at words which are palindromes, where they read forward and backward. Words read forward and backwards in the same way. The name Hannah reads forward and backwards in the same way. There are a few sections of text, as much as a paragraph, that are palindromic. They are very difficult to read and even more difficult to put together, and I've never tried one. The one I think is kind of fun is to think about if Adam, in fact, was an Anglophone at the time when he appeared, and he saw Eve for the first time, he could have said a palindromic greeting, "Madam, I'm Adam," which is the same both ways. And Eve could have cleverly thought a little bit ahead of Adam, suggesting maybe he wasn't the first one around, and said, and I'll just show it one way, but it's a palindrome, "Name no one man. There's somebody else out there," and that goes both ways. A rather clever idea, I thought. And palindromes have a role in history. In World War II, the technique of radio detecting and ranging, which is most people don't realize, is really just radar. And radar itself is a palindrome, as it reads the forward, in this case up and down, in the same way, and was instrumental in having World War II over rather more rapidly than it might otherwise have been. And of course, it is a back and forth. It's sending a signal out, finding an air out like you see here, finding an airplane, for instance, and then it bounces back, retrieving the information, of course. Now, many of you, of course, have books. All of you have books, and people ask to borrow your books, and I've often worried about this because I just know that so-and-so borrows a book from me, I'm probably never going to see it again, even though they are the most honest people around. I write down so-and-so has a book, the paper gets lost, I forget about the book, they forget about that they borrowed the book. And you can think of when you're giving someone a book to read, to reflect upon, you can think about a palindrome. And this is the palindrome. It reads forward and backwards the same way, and of course really tells pretty much the story. You just would like to see it reverse and come back to you overall. Well, I'm not sure that I would necessarily agree with this, but I think there's something to it. The father of modern accounting said, "Without mathematics, there is no art." And mathematics, I think, does get into some very interesting ways of thinking about numbers and symmetry. And there is it's out there. I don't know if it's actually completely true, but if you take any 4, 3, or 2-digit number, it is said, then you reverse that number, which you see here, add them together, you get a palindrome. Well, that happened immediately. So, excuse me, that you have to reverse it one more time, and then you get, of course, 4 sevens as the palindrome. So I took another number, reversed it, added it together, reversed it, added it together, did the same, starting to look like maybe at some point you're going to get to an end of this. And I'm now out to pretty much the end of the calculator that I'm using, because I'm not adding this by hand. And I thought, well, I found the one that doesn't work, and I'll publish a little blog on this or do something like that. Reverse that one and add that one to it, and there it is. And it works. Now, I'd like to see a computer program do this in 1 second or less, but you might have fun with this as a mild amusement. There's another one that I found really quite fascinating. If you take 111,111,111 and square it, multiply by itself, I don't know if you can guess what it does, but it does this, which is a gorgeous palindrome centered around the 9. There's a lot of things that work like that in nature, even more than these, and you can find them on the web in different places, and if you want, or if you've actually, I would say, if you have come up with one or two ideas that weren't mentioned in what I've been talking about, send them to me and maybe we'll have a redo with this. I think there could be probably half a dozen lectures on a topic like this and not really ever say the same thing twice. And I thought keep your lunch hours in the appropriate framework. I want everybody to get back to work. Lynn Gervais wants everybody to get back to work. We haven't solved the budget problem yet. Is to turn a little bit to chemistry. There's just a few simple things, and then I have a couple of items, one item at the end I want to show you. The element phosphorus is P4, and the atoms are arranged in this gorgeous tetrahedral kind of setup. And organic chemists are widely known to like to put molecules down on paper and then see if they can possibly build them with a carbon atom in all of the different positions, such as this prismane-looking structure that's shown on the left. There's a carbon atom inferred at every juncture. Cubane was really a very remarkable molecule that was constructed from simple carbon chains, pulling them together, squeezing them together, just to see if it could be done. We actually did some research in our lab on a derivative of cubane. But cubane being a cube, being 8 carbons and 8 hydrogens, is a kind of a defies the logic. You think of an 8 carbon molecule, you think of octane. And octane, when the carbon chains are long together, that is, they're just extended, it's a liquid. But when they're fused into this arrangement, it's a solid that actually sublimes at 130 degrees. It goes from the gas phase, or from the solid phase to the gas phase, and it doesn't pass through the liquid phase. And this is because once the vibrations have separated the crystals, they just go in straight into the air, an unusual molecule. This is another one that's unusual. It was built by a chemist at Ohio State University called dodecahedrane. It's kind of reminiscent of a soccer ball, which I'll mention in a minute. But the golf people, for whatever reason, thought that they would be rather smart and that they would center their little dimples that are supposedly to give the ball straight flight in pentagonal arrangements. And they call this golf ball the DDH. It's a dodecahedrane. So if you are golfing anywhere, somewhere, sometime, and somebody says, "Oh, I have a DDH here." And he says, "Oh, yeah, do you know what that really means?" And then, of course, they won't want to play golf with you anymore, but being such a smarty pants. And, of course, I think you're all familiar with C60. This is the arrangement of carbon atoms. I'm showing a molecule that's actually been trapped inside of a C60 array, but all of those represent carbon atoms, and it's really the third form of carbon after graphite, diamonds, and buckyballs, as they're called, and the Nobel Prize was awarded a few years ago for the discovery of that, because every time you light a candle, snuff it out, and the soot kind of rises, there's buckyballs in there, the C60 hydrocarbon. It's a perfect arrangement, exactly like a soccer ball. And just to reflect a little bit on the diamond itself, the diamond is only made of carbon, but it has a completely different organization of the atoms. They starts with a 6-chair array. Those of you who have had organic chemistry recognize this kind of molecular model, and it's built up endlessly in this very, very strain-free arrangement of the atoms. And there's another interesting nuance. If at that position we place a nitrogen and two hydrogens, it turns out to be an antiviral agent for reasons that can be explained. But it's a prophylactic agent. You have to take it ahead of time because the nitrogen sort of lines the stomach and prevents viruses from coming into the body or into the digestive tract in the usual way. And it's called, as you might guess, Simitrel. And it's put out by DuPont. And it works, but you have to take it before you get the flu. So if you build this up a little bit more, you can see where it would be extended, and then with a different molecular model set, you get pictures that look like this. And there's different ways to examine it, but it's all carbon atoms all the time, and it's the hardest, almost the hardest substance that's known. Another way of looking at molecules is strictly a simple organic chemical fashion. If you consider this product, monosodium glutamate, as you all know, it helps to flavor food reasonably, but it's a molecule that has a very special organization of the atoms. And I'm going to simplify it. It's not quite as simple as the four balls that are here, but the four balls that extend from the carbon atom are in a tetrahedral arrangement. And when you have that, and you have a carbon chain and then another nitrogen atom and so forth, it's the same principle as what I'm showing. If you make the mirror, think of it as a mirror, and make the mirror image, they look the same, but they are not. And in fact, monosodium glutamate in one form is a flavor enhancer, and then in the other form, it's bitter to taste. And there are other molecules that have this kind of mirror relationship, as it turns out. One of them is the molecule which gives the flavor of spearmint, and the other molecule, which is its non-identical mirror image, and I'll show that these are not identical in a moment. And it's the flavor material in caraway. So if you think of caraway, the seeds that are in rye bread, versus spearmint, which is in gum, they aren't anything like each other. I once mixed in equal parts of each, and I could taste both of them. It was kind of a weird sensation. It was sort of like having gum on your rye bread or something like that. It was odd. But your body will pick this up, and I'll try to indicate how that works in just a moment. But if you take a look at, we remove the mirror in this case, and just simply rotate the one on the right just a little bit and try to make it to show that it's not identical, and you lop it over like so, you see that the red, black, and white are identical, but the blue and the yellow are reversed from one another. They're not identical. They have physiological properties many times that are quite different from one another. Sometimes they're not. And it turns out one of the reasons that drugs cost so much these days is that the one-handed, we'll call it a handed array, maybe just to show it this way, they have different configurations. One configuration might be the active drug, whereas the mirrored configuration might not be active whatsoever. And all of the major drug firms now are mandated to, or all the drug firms are mandated to investigate the physiological properties of both the right and the left-handedness. And in fact, Nexium, the purple pill, really comes from, it's one enantiomer and not the other, and it's a little bit better, just a little bit better, but a lot better in price. And it's only this kind of idea that's involved. And so we call them enantiomers. So somebody says, what did you learn today? You can say, I learned about enantiomers, and then they'll run away, and you don't have to worry about them anymore. It comes from the Greek enantio, or opposite. So the question really is, how is it that the body doesn't just recognize either of those in an equal way? And I have a model that I think illustrates that. Why is there a different body interaction in this kind of situation? This is not a Rubik's Cube, but it's one of those cubes that has about six separate pieces of plastic that integrate together to make a cube, what turns out to be in something like 150,000 different ways. But one way is that there is a space in the middle that can be shown, as you see it here. It's simply an aperture possibility. And the other possibility is that this we'll call an enzyme, or we'll call it a taste bud, or anything that is going to receive one molecule that's handed in one way versus the molecule that's handed in the other way. We'll call it a chiral or handed enantiomeric pocket, perhaps. And if we take the two possible candidates that might fit into that, that would be the candidates of our drugs or the spearmint or the caraway, and you can see that the two blue plastic pieces are not identical. You can play with them endlessly and they're not the same. They are non-identical mirror images, and that's one of the major lessons in organic chemistry. You've had at least you'll be able to pass that part. If you haven't had organic yet, you come to those questions, you'll nail it. It won't be difficult. You have it all down pat. So let's, and you can see that that's to represent a mirror. They just reflect each other. So let's pick one up. Very poor pickup. Obviously not going to make another poorly placed, doesn't show. But this one shows exactly what the story is. There's three blue blocks in a plane, and one goes up, and it has to go down in order to make the molecular interactions in the body. But it doesn't. So it doesn't have an effect, or it has a different effect than the other one. So we'll take that one, that little hole is not filled. So we'll buy that. So we'll take that away, and then if you picture this more or less grabbing it on the top and flipping it up, it'll drop right in and fit exactly in the spot. And then there's some kind of interaction. So that's at least a simple answer to how it works in the body, that there can be two molecules that are so nearly identical, they have exactly the same number of atoms. The atoms are exactly attached in exactly the same way, but yet they're oriented in space differently, and that whole topic is stereochemistry. So you're all up to date on that. That won't be a problem on the midterm, not an issue. I want to conclude and keep you on pretty much on schedule with another Escher picture where he visualizes what's called a Möbius strip. A Möbius strip, you can make yourself a long strip of paper, twist it, glue it together, and it's a single side. You can take a pen, write on that paper, just keep the pen to the paper, and you'll wind up right back where you started from. You aren't on an outside, you're on a single surface. And I think the picture is wonderful. It shows some ants forever crawling on this structure, endlessly going nowhere, of course, but also not leaving the top or the bottom. There is no top or bottom, it's all one surface. And the New Yorker parodied this with, I guess you'd call them people going to work on a Möbius strip in that fashion. Well, I want to show you one little item about a Möbius strip with this object that I have here. Now, this is from the Giant Men's store, wherever it might be. And I won't go through all of the ramifications, but if you twist this once, put it together and then unzip it, which is the equivalent of cutting it with scissors, it will be just one long Möbius strip. But if you take this, twist it once, and twist it one more time, if you're really adept at mathematics, you might be able to figure out what's going to happen. I always thought this was a kind of a curiosity. And we'll unravel this through the two twists. Now, I can't figure out how that happens, but it works every time. I just found it interesting. It's an oddity, like a lot of the things I've talked to with you today about. And I want to just conclude with some source material that you might find of some interest. The way of putting letters together in fascinating fashion, I think this is the brilliant and only way that you should think about a mirror when you write it down, because it is, of course, mirrored all the way across, left and right. It's sort of a palindromic view of a very special way to illustrate. And that special way was illustrated by a young author named Scott Kim a few years ago. The book is called Inversions, And if he's styled his letters. He can style many names. If you want to change your signature now and get in all kinds of trouble at the bank and so forth, you can maybe make your signature in such a way that it reads forwards and backwards in the same fashion, maybe. But this book of inversions, I think it should be available in paperback. But what I wanted to show you is that he's hanging upside down. And if you just twist this picture around, you're right back where you started from. Really brilliant piece of work that he did. It's just filled with little ideas along these same kinds of lines using symmetry. And this book, The New Ambidextrous Universe, or The Old Ambidextrous Universe by Martin Gardner. He was the puzzle guru for Scientific American for a very long time. He passed away a couple of years ago. That book has many examples of the kind that I selected from in this talk today. So I'd be happy to answer any questions, and it'll keep you on your schedules, and I thank you for your attention. Or you're free to go, and and lunch will not be served, I'm afraid. Are there any questions? If there are, come up after, and I'll be glad to deal with whatever I can deal with.
On behalf of everyone here and the campus community, thanks very much for a very interesting talk, Professor.
Thanks. Pleasure.